Hello, my name is Aaron, and you are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, June 12th. The first article on the front page, Pottawatomie County reports highest single-day total of new COVID-19 cases of pandemic. New numbers include spike among young adults, by Mike Brownlee. COVID-19 remains a threat in Council Bluffs and Pottawatomie County. Thursday, the county reported the highest single-day total of positive cases, 40, since the pandemic began. The number of cases tracked by Pottawatomie County Public Health has increased by more than 150 in less than a week, from 317 on June 5th to 492 on Thursday. The newest cases include 25 among the 18 to 40 age range, which has been hit the hardest by the coronavirus on a case level in the county, especially lately. There have been 206 cases in the county in that region, with the next highest 158 in the 41 to 60 range. Matt Wyant with Pottawatomie County Public Health said that the virus not affecting the health of the young adult demographic as much as others, telling those individuals, "We need you to stay home and stop the spread to contain it," is not working as much as we'd like, but they're still spreading the virus to others. It's highly contagious, Wyant said. They should be wearing face masks, taking all the proper precautions in those younger ages. Unless it affects them directly, it makes them harder to take it seriously. Wyant said he has seen wake-up calls among positive individuals in that age range or those have loved ones affected. The county is working with 492 positive individuals, which includes epidemiologically linked cases. Pottawatomie County Public Health has said epi-linked cases are individuals who've had contact with a confirmed positive individual and are exhibiting symptoms but have not been tested. The department provides assistance to those individuals and treats them like individuals who have tested positive. The state doesn't count epi-linked cases in its numbers. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, there have been 454 positive tests in the state out of 5,475 people tested, for a positive rate of 8.3%, which ticked up from 8% on Wednesday. Wyant said the rate for the test results reported Thursday was above 11%. A few factors have played into increased cases in the county. Testing capacity has increased greatly, with 1 in 17 county residents now having been tested. A Test Iowa site allows residents to be tested with an addition to other testing venues. Warm weather combined with a large period of quarantine has people ready to get out has also led to more cases. Additionally, the state has rolled back public gathering restrictions. On Wednesday, Governor Kim Reynolds said businesses can operate at 100% capacity, but advised establishments and individuals to adhere to social distancing and other preventative guidance. The Porch Restaurant, located on South 24th Street, announced in a Facebook post Thursday it is closed and will remain so through the weekend after a staff member tested positive for COVID-19, while a few others have been exposed or are showing symptoms. In announcing the positive test and closure, the restaurant said the positive individual did not have contact with customers, is experiencing mild symptoms, and is self-isolating at home. The business said it will do a deep clean with plans to reopen on Monday. "Thank you for understanding, and we look forward to seeing you all soon," the restaurant said in the post. Wyant said Pottawatomie County Public Health has been in contact with the restaurant. He noted efforts to strike a balance between reopening the economy and mitigate the disease. "Right now is a double-edged sword," Wyant asked about reopenings. "There's a need to reopen for sustainability of business in the area, but at the same time, allowing that many people into an environment is perfect for the spread of the virus." Wyant noted the instructions from the governor for business to encourage and individuals to abide by social distancing and other guidelines. "We're getting calls that that's just not happening," he said. "With more events and more people at businesses, it's inevitable we'll see an increase in the virus." Wyant said now it not the time for people to let their guard down. Along with positive tests and the positive rate, Wyant said another key metric is hospitalizations. Currently, 7 county residents COVID-19 are hospitalized, 2 from Wednesday. The highest the county seen during the pandemic is 8. There are 3 patients in intensive care and 1 on a ventilator. 10 COVID-19 patients in the county have died, predominantly in higher age ranges. Of Thursday's 40 cases, 36 individuals are from Council Bluffs, 2 are from Carter Lake, 1 from Avoca, and 1 is from Neola. 1 case is epi-linked and the others were tested between Sunday and Tuesday. As noted, 25 are 18 to 40 years old, 3 are 17 or younger, 9 are 41 to 60, 2 are 61 to 80, and 1 is 81 years or older. As of Thursday, 258 individuals have recovered and 198 are self-isolating. Based on Pottawatomie County Public Health contact tracing investigations, 146 cases are the result of community spread. Pottawatomie County Public Health again emphasized the importance of social distancing, excellent hand washing, disinfecting surfaces, and wearing face coverings when in public. If you are sick, stay home. Douglas County, Nebraska records 1 more COVID-19 death, 97 additional cases. Douglas County, Nebraska on Thursday reported another death tied to COVID-19 as well as 97 new cases of the illness. The person who died was a man in his 60s with no known underlying health conditions. His death brings to 54 the total number of deaths in the county from the pandemic. The 97 new COVID-19 cases bumped the county's total to 5,433 on Thursday. A total of 39,730 Douglas County residents had been tested as of midnight Wednesday. According to county data, 124 patients were hospitalized in the Omaha area Thursday with COVID-19, with 36 of them on ventilators. COVID-19 in southwest Iowa. Harrison County reported 5 new cases on Thursday, 3 individuals 17 or younger, and 1 18 to 40, and 1 41 to 60. There have been 33 cases in the county, according to Harrison County Home and Public Health. All 5 are home and isolation. Mills County Public Health reported an additional case Wednesday afternoon, an individual 18 years or old or younger. The person is self-isolating. The county has had 22 positive cases. Crawford County reported 14 new cases over the past 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, while Harrison and Shelby counties reported 3 new cases. Monona County reported 2 and Cass County reported 1 over that time, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. There are 2 new test Iowa sites open or soon to open in that region. A site opened at the Clarinda Regional Health Center in Page County on June 3rd. A site at the St. Anthony Clinic in Denison in Crawford County opened on Wednesday. The state website reported Monday that there have been 575 positive cases of COVID-19 out of 2,236 tested in Crawford County. Denison is home to multiple meatpacking plants, which have been hit hard by the coronavirus throughout the state and country. Here's a look at numbers in southwest Iowa based on data from the counties and coronavirus.iowa.gov. Pottawatomie County, 454 cases. Pottawatomie County Public Health is tracking 492, including epi-linked cases. 258 recoveries per the county, 5,475 tests. 8.3% of those have come back positive. 10 deaths. Mills County, 22 cases, 21 recoveries, 1,386 tests, 1.6%. Harrison County, 33 cases, 25 recoveries, 662 tests, 5%. Cass County, 14 cases, 12 recoveries, 535 tests, 2.6%. Shelby County, 430 cases, 35 recoveries, 494 tests, 8.7%. Montgomery County, 9 cases, 6 recoveries, 458 tests, 2%, 2 deaths. Monona County, 22 cases, 20 recoveries, 477 tests, 4.8%. Crawford County, 589 cases, 347 recoveries, 2,290 tests, 25.7%, 2 deaths. Page County, 16 cases, 11 recoveries, 801 tests, 2%. Fremont County, 4 cases, 2 recoveries, 232 tests, 1.7%. In Regional Medical Coordination Center Region 4, which includes Pottawatomie, Mills, Harrison, Cass, Crawford, Shelby, Fremont, Montgomery, Page, Adams, Audubon, and Taylor counties, there were 8 patients hospitalized, with 3 in intensive care. The region has 191 patient beds available, 21 intensive care beds available, and 65 ventilators available. 2 hospitalized COVID-19 patients are on the ventilator. Information about COVID-19. Symptoms in people who have been exposed to coronavirus can include fever, cough, or shortness of breath, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The symptoms may appear in as few as 2 days or as long as 14 days after exposure. Most people experience mild or moderate symptoms that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. Older adults and people with existing health problems are among those particularly susceptible to more severe illnesses, including pneumonia. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend the use of masks when out in public. Make sure it covers the mouth and nose. Face shields are an option as well, as they cover the eyes. Public health officials recommend stay home as much as possible, self-monitor for symptoms, call your physician if symptoms appear, cover coughs and sneezes with a tissue or your upper arm elbow, wash hands frequently with soap and water, clean and disinfect frequently touched objects and surfaces. Go to testiowa.com to take an assessment and schedule a test. For those struggling with mental health during the pandemic, yourlifeiowa.org has several resources, including a hotline at 855-581-8111 and a text-friendly line at 855-895-8398. Additionally, the Hope for Iowa Crisis Hotline connects individuals in crisis to a helping hand with the resources to address and improve mental wellness. The hotline is available 24 hours a day. Call 844-673-4469. The next article on the front page, Roth City Pools to Open for Broader Use, by Susan Payne. City pools are scheduled to open Monday, but with Governor Kim Reynolds' eased restrictions announced Wednesday, the city will open the facilities for broader use and recreation. The city announced changes to admittance in the use restrictions on Thursday. Reservations to Council Bluffs Pools, Cattlemen, and Pirate Cove are required under 2 sessions, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. Pools are required to operate with a 100-person capacity per session. No walk-ins will be admitted. Upon entry, patrons are required to have temperature checks. Temperatures above 100.4 will be denied entry. Face coverings are required in outdoor areas and bathhouses, but not in the pool, when a 6 feet physical distance cannot be maintained. Pools have masks available for $1. The city said the patrons will be asked to leave if they do not follow the guidelines, noting the rules were developed in conjunction with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention state and county authorities. While COVID-19 precautions are implemented, information on swim lessons and pool parties will be released by the city in the coming weeks. The city said since restrictions are being lifted earlier than expected, it is hiring more lifeguards and cashiers. Go to bit.ly/37TGHWZ for more information to apply. To make a pool session reservation, call Cattlemen at 712-328-4939 or Pirate Cove at 712-328-4694. Across the river, Omaha announced Thursday its outdoor city pools will not open this summer. Officials are preparing to reopen the city's 3 indoor pools located in county centers Montclair, Mockingbird, and Common Ground in Elkhorn. Omaha Mayor Gene Stothart said at the press conference, "Those pools could open by July," she said. The next article on the front page, Neola Hodo Days canceled. Pottawatomie County Fair scales back. Bikes on the 100 block still on. This is by Susan Payne and Mike Brownlee. Neola's Hodo Days, a celebration that began in 1946 to celebrate the return of soldiers from World War II, has been canceled due to the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. Community member Bobby Munch announced the cancellation Wednesday. The Hodo Committee regretfully has decided to cancel 2020 Hodo Days, having spent weeks in agonizing discussions about if and how to carry out Hodo Days during the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. We felt the gravity of the decision on our shoulders, Munch stated. Ultimately, we placed the best interests of the community first. At the forefront of public safety, Munch said the committee considered students from tri-centers and area schools who would return to classes days before the celebration. Neola's Labor Day weekend brings nearly 5,000 people into the area, congregating along the parade route and making social distancing impossible, she said. Students are integral to the celebration from Tri-Center FFA, doing setup and takedown, high school and junior high bands marching and performing, the younger kids chasing treats tossed from parade floats, Munch said. The risk of a COVID-19 outbreak spreading to school and community, potentially forcing another school closure at a time when students and parents are finally returning to normalcy, was too much to bear. Although the disappointment has been shared among committee members and community alike, Munch said next year will be a very special renewal of the great tradition that is Hodo Days. To the east, the Pottawatomie County Fair, held in Avoca, said Thursday that it has canceled arena shows and open class events at the fair, including the Queen Contest. In a Facebook post, the fair board said there will be no ATV and snowmobile races, mud races, tractor pulls, or open class events. 4-H and FFA events are still planned. This was a tough decision to make, but the health and welfare of our community comes first. Our youth will be able to exhibit the work they have done on their projects with a different format, the board said. We will be live streaming the livestock shows and posting pictures and results of all the youth contests on our website and Facebook pages. We thank you for your support and understanding and hope to get back to the type of fair we all love in 2021. In Council Bluffs, bikes on the 100 block will be held this month and in July and August, according to organizers. The first event will be held June 18th, starting at 5 p.m. Shoot to Thrill will be the musical act. The last article on the front page, IWCC Board Committee Create Profile of Desired President, by Tim Johnson. The Iowa Western Community College trustees and search committee members now have a profile of the candidate they hope to hire as the college's next president. Based on more than 100 responses to an online survey and comments made at four public forums Wednesday, two in Council Bluffs and one in Clarinda in Harland, Julie Golder, Vice President of Search Services for the Association of Community College Trustees, wrote up a draft that was amended and revised by the Iowa Western Presidential Search Committee Thursday morning, then tweaked and approved by the college's Board of Trustees Thursday afternoon. There have been hundreds of voices that have been heard to put this together, Golder said. Board President Brent Sirgis, Vice President Connie Hornbeck, and board members Dr. John Marshall and Stan Sibley, who also sit on the search committee, felt good about the committee's work. 18 of the committee's 20 members attended in person, and the other two participated remotely, Sirgis said. Everybody was very engaged, and it went very well, he said. After a brief description of college and area, the profile begins with a general statement about the desired candidate and a list of six opportunities and challenges he or she will face. The president of IWCC will be a strong communicator and collaborator, serve as a visible spokesperson throughout the region, make a long-term commitment to the college, and address the following opportunities and challenges. 1. Increase enrollment and retention by modernizing processes, promoting and showcasing IWCC strengths, and offering innovative programs and support services to attract students from both inside and outside of IWCC's service area. 2. Continue to build relationships throughout the state and region and increase external funding to strengthen and expand career, technical, and trade programs. Facilitate transfer articulation with four-year institutes, improve online learning, and collaborate with over 30 K-12 districts and schools systems. 3. Further develop strategic partnerships with businesses and industry in order to best serve and nimbly respond to changing needs. 4. Assess, repair, and renovate the repurposing of spaces and facilities to meet enrollment and student service demands. 5. Provide visionary leadership, cultivate a climate of inclusion and trust, and focus on decisions which are in the best interest of all students. 6. Function within financial realities. The profile goes on to list numeral ideal characteristics that the candidate who is selected. The president should be committed to academic excellence and diversity and have experience providing oversight and accountability for a large and complex budget, the profile states. The person should have experience implementing bond projects and overseeing construction projects and facilities, as well as proven success in developing an executing a strategic plan and a successful track record of building new relationships and fundraising. The candidate should also have experience engaging with a foundation, alumni, and community leaders while developing a culture of philanthropy. The profile states, the board added the reference to the foundation and also called for a link connecting candidates with information about the area. He or she should be an academic leader who works in partnership with faculty and staff and supports interdepartmental communication and collaboration, as well as ongoing modernization for different modalities of learning. The person should be a compassionate leader who possesses a comprehensive understanding of the needs of all students and a demonstrated cultural competency to meeting the needs of students with diverse abilities and diverse academic, cultural, and socioeconomic backgrounds, the profile states. The candidate should have experience working at an institution with pre-college experiences, concurrent enrollment opportunities, athletic programs, and student housing. He or she should be an exceptional collaborator and mediator who is committed to empowering, retaining, and working with faculty, staff, and administrators, and a leader of integrity who is open-minded, transparent, honest, approachable, and enthusiastic. The profile will be posted soon on the Iowa Western website at iwcc.edu under the main picture at President Search. By Monday, it will also be posted on ACCT's website. Our next article, Iowa Unemployment Claims Rise Last Week Despite Reopenings, by Christopher Rugabar of the Associated Press, Des Moines. The number of people filing initial unemployment claims in Iowa jumped last week, even as the state continued reopening after taking steps intended to slow spread of the coronavirus, according to the state statistics released Thursday. Iowa Workforce Development reported that 10,112 people filed initial claims in the week ending June 6th. That's compared with 6,920 people who filed in the previous week. There were 159,966 continuing weekly unemployment claims last week, a decline of 2,596 from the previous week. The number of initial claims rose in Pottawatomie County as well, from 5,966 the week ending May 30th to 8,912 the week ending June 6th. The county has 149,417 continuing claims, down from 153,018 the previous week. Statewide, the largest number of claims came from people unemployed in manufacturing at 2,080. Nationally, nearly 1.5 million people applied for unemployment benefits last week. Nearly 21 million people in the country are officially classified as unemployed. The latest figure from the Labor Department marked the 10th straight weekly decline in applications for joblessness aid since they peaked in mid-March when the coronavirus hit hard. Still, the pace of layoffs remains historically high. The total number of people who are receiving unemployment aid fell slightly, a sign that some people who were laid off when restaurants, retail chains, and small businesses suddenly shut down have been recalled to work. The figures are consistent with a labor market that has begun what will be a slow and difficult healing process, said Nancy Vanden Hooten, an economist at Oxford Economics. Still, initial jobless claims remain at levels that at the start of the year might have seemed unthinkable. Last week's jobs report showed that employees added 2.5 million jobs in May, an unexpected increase that suggested that job market has bottomed out. But the recovery has begun slowly. Though the unemployment rate unexpectedly declined from 14.7%, it is still a high 13.3%. And even with the May hiring gain, just 1 in 9 jobs that were lost in March and April have returned. Nearly 21 million people are officially classified as unemployed. Even those figures don't capture the full scope of the damage to the job market, including people the government said had been erroneously categorized as employed in May, jobs report, and those who lost jobs but didn't look for new ones. 32.5 million people are out of work, economists estimate. That would have raised May's unemployment rate to 19.7%. Thursday's reports also show that an additional 706,000 people applied for jobless benefits last week under a new program for self-employed and gig workers that made them eligible for aid for the first time. These figures aren't adjusted for seasonal variations, so the government doesn't include them in the official count. The weekly reports on applications for unemployment benefits track layoffs, but they don't directly account for hiring, which can offset layoffs. The surprise job gain in May suggests that some employers are recalling laid-off workers. Private real-time data also points to steady, if modest, rehiring. Data from Kronos, whose software tracks workers' hours, shows that the number of shifts worked has recovered steadily since bottoming in mid-April. Shifts have risen 25% since then, recovering nearly half the work that was lost to the pandemic-induced business shutdowns. The growth in shifts works indicates that furloughed employees are being called back to work as each state opens up, said Dave Gilbertson at Kronos Executive. 24 states reported a rise in applications for jobless aid last week, up from just 4 the week before. Though the state data isn't adjusted for seasonal trends, so it can be violated. California, New York, and Massachusetts reported sharp increases. Florida, Georgia, and Texas, some of the earliest states to reopen their economy, reported large declines. In February, the economy fell into a deep recession, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the association of economists that is the official arbiter of recessions. The Federal Reserve estimated Wednesday that the economy will shrink 6.5% this year. That would be by far the deepest annual contraction on records dating to World War II. Even as restaurants, bars, and gyms reopen, they are doing so at lower capacity, and consumer spreading on such services remains far below what it was before the viral outbreak. Unemployment benefits are providing significant support for jobless Americans, with total payments having reached $94 billion in May, 6 times the previous record set in 2010, just after the previous recession. This time, the benefits include an additional $600 a week from the federal government. But that extra benefit is set to end July 31st, and the Trump administration opposes extending it. Its opposition has set up a possible clash with House Democrats, who have approved legislation to extend the $600 a week in federal benefits for an additional 6 months. Republicans in Congress argue that the extra $600, which comes on top of state benefits that average about $375 nationwide, means many of the unemployed are receiving more money from jobless benefits than they earned at their old jobs. Republicans argue that this discourages people from returning to work. Studies suggest that roughly two-thirds of the recipients are receiving total unemployment aid that exceeds their previous paychecks. But many workers who also worry about returning to their old jobs for fear of contracting the virus, and recipients who receive aid can lose their benefits if they turn down job offers. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, June 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. James A. Cannon. James A. Cannon passed away June 9, 2020, and was born November 23, 1950. James, Jim, Jimmy, Uncle Jim, CSM Jim, Babe, Boo Boo, Mr. C, Grandpa, Dad, no matter who you were, you called him whatever felt right. His life was a life defined by loving service to others, giving freely of his time to friends, family, co-workers, and strangers in need. He volunteered at schools, nonprofits, and church, never for recognition, often to the credit of others. He was preceded in death by his parents, Gentry and Marianne Cannon, sister Nadine Red, brother Michael Frank Cannon. He is survived by his wife, Connie, sons Jason, spouse Andrea, Christopher, Sean, spouse Joplin Cannon, grandchildren Elijah, Elena, Eleanor, Elira, Addison, Sean, Keller, Daniel, and Lincoln, brother Robert Cannon, sister Sandy, spouse Gary Petrie, nieces, nephews, family, friends, and countless others blessed by his strength, kindness, and humor. Service Monday 11 a.m. at the First Church of the Nazarene. Visitation Sunday 2 to 5 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Memorials may be directed to Council Bluffs First Church of the Nazarene Potawatomi Arts Culture Entertainment Pace or Eastern Nebraska Office of Aging. And now moving to the sports section. Lewis Central fired up for 2020 season by Derek Noren. First-year Lewis Central baseball coach Jim Waters has been around the game his whole life, but this year is certainly different. Rewind several weeks prior, and it didn't seem like there would be a high school baseball season in Iowa. As we know, with COVID-19, things change fast. Surprise would be the word. I didn't think we would play with everything that was going on, Waters said. Weekly, everything was changing and it seemed like things were getting worse, not better, so I'm surprised by it. The new word is excited, especially for the Lewis Central seniors. For them, this year is about building off of last season when the Titans went 23-14 overall, 13-1 in Hawkeye 10 Conference, and advanced to Class 4A Substate 8 semifinal. With that, and the idea of not having a season in the rearview mirror, the players have adopted a new emotion. Anxious, Waters said. We have an hour before practice that kids can voluntarily come and work and extra things, and we get 100% participation. So obviously the kids have been pretty excited to get out there. They're obviously pretty anxious for that first game to take place and get the season going. And anxious they should be. Of three Titans that hit over .40 last season, Lewis Central returns senior Brayson Sharon, .419 batting average in 2019, and junior Jonah Pomrenk, .417. Also back is senior Jordan Wardlow, who hit .301, hit a team-high 8 home runs and tied Pomrenk with the team lead in RBI with 29. The kid Wardlow swings a Division I bat from the left side of the plate. He has Division I power. It's just a matter of how disciplined he's going to be at the plate. That's what's going to determine how many home runs he's going to hit. He's that kind of a threat. Sharon, a senior, also pitches, last season posting a 4-1 record in 6 starts with a 2.23 ERA. Easton Dermody was 4-2, 3.68 ERA, and J.C. Dermody was 4-1, 1.56 ERA. The bottom line is LC has arms. From a pitching standpoint, we'll start at the top. Easton Dermody is going to be very strong along with Bryson Sharon. We look for Tyler Huttman to come in and close games out. He got a little funky side swinging action, Waters said. We have Jordan Wardlow on the hill. He's shown to have a really strong arm. We have J.C. Dermody, who can hit his spots pretty well and is a sneaky fast pitcher. Guys who have come on recently are Nolan Miller, Aaron Harrington, and Kale Malski. Given this year's unique challenges, Waters has been encouraged by the spirit he's seen from his squad. My philosophy has always been practice should be more difficult than the actual contest. That's what we've installed at Lewis Central. We have some pretty rigorous practices, Waters said. If that all works out, the games should be a little easier than practices and should lead to good things. Our next sports article, Jordan Talks to Hornets About Winning, Being Uncomfortable, by Steve Redd of the Associated Press, Charlotte, North Carolina. Michael Jordan helped build the Chicago Bulls into a winner as a player. He's desperate to do the same thing in Charlotte as the owner of the Hornets. Charlotte players say Jordan spoke to them recently via video conference call about what it takes to be a champion, emphasizing the need for accountability, even if it means making teammates comfortable. Those are some of the same qualities that were on display during the 10-part documentary The Last Dance, which focused on Jordan's sixth and final NBA championship run with the Bulls. In the hour-long conference call that came after the conclusion of The Last Dance, Charlotte point guard Devontae Graham said Jordan told players they can't be uncomfortable calling out teammates in practice when things aren't going as planned or mistakes become repetitive. That's going to make you guys even better, Graham said, reiterating Jordan's remarks. You'll bond better, your team is stronger, there's more of a respect level, instead of not saying anything and letting guys mess up over and over and over again, and you're losing and losing. Jordan hasn't come close to matching his success as a player since taking over majority control of the Hornets 10 years ago. Charlotte has never made it out of the first round of the playoffs and has only won 3 postseason games in the Jordan era. In an effort to stop that cycle of mediocrity, Jordan hired Mitch Kupchak as the team's new general manager in 2018, and the Hornets have since embarked on a remodeling process, which included parting ways with the 3-time All-Star Kemba Walker last offseason in an effort to focus on developing young players. Jordan took questions from players and spoke directly about the difference between what it takes to win in the regular season and the playoffs. Hornets center Cody Zeller said that was an important message for a young team to hear. A lot of guys on our team haven't played in the playoffs and don't understand the attention to detail you have to play with the playoffs, Zeller said. That's what I enjoyed hearing from MJ, especially as a younger team. Jordan's tenacity and desire to win at all costs were exhibited during The Last Dance. That meant, at times, emotions boiled over at Bulls practices, resulting in altercations between teammates, including one notable exchange of blows between Jordan and Steve Kerr. Hornets guard Terry Rozier joked that after watching The Last Dance, he probably would have got into a few fistfights with Jordan, too. I would have taken the Steve Kerr route, Rozier said with a laugh. I'm super competitive. But Rozier is not sure Jordan's aggressive approach would work with some of his generation's players. I feel like you have to pick your poison, Rozier said. One thing with being teammates with guys in this league is you have to learn who they are first. Some people don't like to be confronted in front of others. Some people you have to pull aside. So I feel like it is a mixture of learning your teammates and knowing when to call them out so that people don't have a bad taste in their mouth about one another. Zeller said Jordan admitted as much in the meeting. He said the 57-year-old Jordan talked about his post-Bulls tenure with the Washington Wizards when his feedback and criticism wasn't well received. He said he wishes that he would have done that a little bit differently. In Washington, Zeller said, the next generation of players that had come in didn't really want to hear the same feedback and the harshness that he used during his days in Chicago. He wishes that he would have taken Jerry Stackhouse under his wing and taught him how to be a better leader, as opposed to trying to do it all himself. Our next sports article. If you build it, baseball plans games at Field of Dreams, but will they come? By Scott McFedridge of the Associated Press, Dyersville. Spurred by a voice telling him, if you build it, he will come, the Iowa farmer played by Kevin Costner dutifully carved a baseball field out of his cornfield and then watched as shoeless Joe Jackson and his Chicago White Sox teammates strode out of the stocks and onto the Field of Dreams. Major League Baseball is building another field a few hundred yards down a corn-lined path from the famous movie site in eastern Iowa. But unlike the original, it's unclear whether teams will show up for a game this time as the league and its players struggle to agree on plans for a coronavirus-shortened season. The owners of the Field of Dreams and residents of the farming community of Dyersville desperately hope so, saying that after months of isolation and loss caused by the virus, not only their area but the entire country could use a boost, like seeing the scheduled August 13th game between the New York Yankees and White Sox go ahead as planned. For both baseball and the general public, what a match made in heaven that would be for this year, said Keith Rahe, now a tourism official but who previously farmed a half mile from the Field of Dreams and vividly remembers the scorching summer of 1988 when the movie was filmed. Just to have something to feel good about, how do you measure that? Major League Baseball announced plans for the game nearly a year ago, making it the latest regular season game held at irregular locations from Fort Bragg, North Carolina for a July 4th celebration to annual games at Bowman Stadium, a minor league ballpark in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, the town where the Little League World Series is played. As Commissioner Rob Manfred said in announcing the game, we look forward to celebrating the movie's enduring message of how baseball brings people together at this special cornfield in Iowa. But more than 2 months after the league's scheduled opener in March, no games have been played and no one knows for sure if there will be a season, much less a contest in a cornfield. That has people like Dyersville Mayor Jim Heavens a little down, but not only because of the missed economic boost for his city of 4,000, but because of the chance the game offered to show the world his town. Heavens notes the bustling community, bracketed by a grain elevator in the twin brick towers of the Basilica of St. Francis Xavier, is overwhelmingly Catholic, proudly frugal, and always ready for some baseball. Though in describing Dyersville, he quips that after 25 years there, I'm fairly new in town. Haven said a game at the Field of Dreams officially within city limits, but a few miles from downtown, through farmland, and past silver-domed silos, is just what baseball needs. Small town Iowa, baseball is still a big thing here, he said. It's kind of like we're right in the middle of Americana, in the middle of an Iowa cornfield, and what better place to play baseball? The region is quintessential Midwest, with narrow roads cutting a circuitous pass through fields of corn and soybeans that stretch over undulating hills, interrupted not only by weathered barns and tidy farmhouses. The farmland is among the most valuable in the nation, and much of the grain grown there is hauled only 25 miles east to the Mississippi River, where it's carried on barges to points south. The anticipated matchup, officially a home game for the White Sox 180 miles west of Chicago, was expected to be a $9 million economic windfall for Dyersville and nearby Dubuque, with plans for 4 days of concerts, exhibits, and other events. The Twilight game was supposed to be played before 8,000 people and under lights erected solely for the event, and while the field will remain, the rest is supposed to be removed. The Field of Dreams site is open to visitors who, at no charge, can run the bases and see if they can smack a ball into corn stalks that now stand about a foot tall. They also can sit on wooden planks where actor James Earl Jones, playing a baseball-loving author, watched Ray Liotta as Jackson, a real-life player who was banned from the game because of his role in World Series-fixing Black Sox scandal. Lately, visitors who have been able to gaze across the corn at towering light stands and see the deep green of professional-quality outfield. Jeremiah and Janice Bronson celebrated their 15th anniversary by driving with their three young children more than 2 hours from Ames, Iowa, to the Field of Dreams. Their plans to attend an Elton John concert in Des Moines were thwarted when the coronavirus forced postponement of the show, so they instead drove to Dyersville to tour the farmhouse that overlooks the field and hit balls from home plate. James Earl Jones says in the movie that baseball is constant and this is an unchanging part of our childhood, said Jeremiah Bronson, who intends to return if the MLB game is held, regardless of if he can get a ticket. This is going to be here after we're gone. This is going to be here for our kids, bring their kids too. For Go the Distance Baseball, the company that now owns the Field of Dreams site and plans to build a complex of youth baseball and softball fields, the talk of playing a game began 5 years ago. Now, after an excruciating waiting game through the spring, a decision will have to come soon as the planned game day approaches. These are uncharted waters for everybody, said Roman Weinberg, the company's director of operations. We're all in this together, and we understand that. We understand the best choice for Major League Baseball in 2020 comes first. Our next article, Tyson food worker dies as virus cripples Iowa County, Storm Lake, Associated Press. A longtime employee of Tyson Foods in Storm Lake has died of the coronavirus as an outbreak centering around the pork processing plant hammers the region, an attorney said Wednesday. Ken Jones, 60, died last week after falling ill and spending about 2 weeks in a hospital, said Willis Hamilton, a lawyer representing his estate. Jones, a resident of Alta, was a maintenance employee who worked at the plant for 12 years, Hamilton said. He leaves behind a wife and two children, one adult and 1 9-year-old. It's a shock to the family, said Hamilton, who has filed a workers' compensation claim on its behalf. Tyson announced last week that 591 employees at the Storm Lake plant have tested positive for the virus out of more than 2,300 who were tested. The outbreak has fueled exploding cases counts in Buena Vista County, where more than 1,300 of roughly 20,000 residents have become infected. The county has confirmed 4 virus-related deaths in recent days. Tyson spokesperson Liz Croston wouldn't say how many of its Storm Lake employees have died after contracting the virus. She said that losing even one team member is too many. Workers' advocates and Democratic lawmakers have expressed outrage over the outbreak, which come after Tyson plants in Iowa have already experienced devastating outbreaks. Several other Tyson workers across the state have died. Tennis golf tournaments may be in financial trouble due to pandemic, by Howard Friedrich of the Associated Press. When he first contemplated the prospect of a U.S. Open without fans because of the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S. Tennis Association's chief revenue officer figured there was no way it could work. Liu Shur eventually came around to embracing the idea of a closed-door Grand Slam tournament if it is held at all. A decision is expected as soon as next week because it still could make money even if millions were fortified with zero on-site recipients from tickets, hospitality, food and beverage or merchandise sales. Certainly better than not playing. It still makes sense financially and as a way to keep the sport vibrant and engage fans, Shur said. As you get to lower level tournaments, it becomes a much harder conversation. golf, which resumed Thursday in Fort Worth, Texas, also could take a real hit because of the virus and the recession. Week in, week out, events in tennis, where the pro tours are suspended at least until the late July, do not bring in TV rights fees like the U.S. Open, which averages $70 million per year in the host country alone. Some of the smallest tours stop even need to buy airtime. The biggest team leagues, such as the NFL and NBA, seem to be in good shape because they derive most of their money from TV contracts worth billions each season. NASCAR, which returned last month with a flurry of races at empty tracks but announced plans Tuesday to begin allowing small numbers of fans, relies mainly on broadcast rights fees, which hundreds of millions annually. Another sport built around events at independent tracks, horse racing, will begin its Triple Crown Series stands spectators at the Belmont Stakes in New York on June 20th with what might approach $100 million in online gambling. But tennis and golf rely to a much greater degree on income generated from having people on hand, especially for high-end tickets and hospitality. The economic framework for each tournament varies in both sports. Smaller events especially would suffer financially if live audiences are eliminated or restricted. One possible fallout of reduced revenue around tennis could be reduced prize money, even at a major championship like the U.S. Open. Another, some tournaments simply could disappear. Will a 15,000-seat stadium need to seat only 5,000 because of social distancing? Will that be a tennis future? If so, will the sport survive? Said James Blake, a former top five player and tournament director at the Miami Open, one of more than 40 tennis events scrapped since March because of the COVID-19 outbreak. You either cut the prize money a little bit, Blake said, or you have one or two more years where these companies and tournaments can remain financially solvent, and then they can't do it anymore. Here is a look how economic structures of certain sports mean they will be affected differently by the pandemic. NASCAR. Race hosts receive 65% of NASCAR's $8.2 billion 10-year television package that in turn accounts for about 60 to 70% of track revenues, so it makes sense to move forward despite losing another revenue streams. Assuming that we get all our races in, NASCAR and its tracks will come through this okay, Dover International Speedway Incorporated President and CEO Michael Titoian said. It's not that we're going to be flying through it. It's not that we're going to have any kind of impact. Of course we will. It will set us back, but not long enough to be devastating. Horse racing. The Kentucky Derby, according to an estimate a few years ago, makes only a little more than 10% of its revenue from broadcast rights. That's why Churchill Downs, Belmont, and Santa Anita Park all recently reopened to racing, even if no fans are present. The main source of revenue, online gambling, still functions just fine. Last year's Belmont Days drew $102 million in wagers with no Triple Crown on the line, and $91 million of that was off-track betting. PGA Tour. Eliminating spectators means eliminating significant chunks of tournament's revenue. That starts with big earning hospitality tents and programs that can bring in upward of $1 million and including other revenue sources like merchandise and ticket sales. Tournaments rely heavily on title sponsors. We wouldn't be able to return without them, Commissioner Jay Mohanan said. But it's the local sponsorship that sustains each tournament. And if discretionary spending by corporations dries up, the effects could be greater in 2021. Tennis. The U.S. Open, as of now, scheduled to begin in late August, gets about a third of its roughly $400 million in annual revenue from various American and international TV right deals. About a quarter is from sponsorship deals, some of which would be renegotiated if there were no on-site fans. An additional 35% or so comes from tickets and hospitality, with less than 10% from food and beverage merchandising, etc., all of which would vanish without the hundreds of thousands who normally attend. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, June 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can access a recording of this newspaper and all the others on our website at iowaradioreading.org. As always, thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.